come you masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe. But I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, fear to bring children into the world, before threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know, I'm younger than you. That even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I watch while you lord down to your deathbed, and I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
You're listening to Blast Furnace Radio, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with all the feedback and mistakes that you can eat. Tonight we have with us Roy Bourgeois, a tape of Roy Bourgeois speaking here in the tri-state, speaking down in West Virginia at the Jesuit College of West Virginia. And we're getting ready for the Schools of America's. Getting ready to go down there, and without a permit, without a place to have a web radio station, we're going to show them that we don't want to bow to the masters of war no more. So yowza, yowza, yowza. Here is Roy Bourgeois, the School of America's Watch.
1, 2, 3. Testing. 1, 2, 3. Three. Testing. 1, 2, 3. Again? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing. 1, 2, 3.
He's a decorated military veteran serving in Vietnam, a recipient of the Purple Heart. After leaving Vietnam, he entered the seminary where he studied with the Mary Knoll missionaries and became a priest in 1972. He worked in Bolivia for 5 years where he became an outspoken critic of the government and its treatment of the poor there. That was eventually to force him from the country. In 1980, he became involved in El Salvador, where four U.S. churchwomen were brutally raped and murdered. Two of those were personal friends. So Father Roy's involvement in countries south of the United States, South and Central America, have revealed to him that at times U.S. foreign policy is not in keeping with certain human rights which the world or the human family tries to espouse. He has produced two videos which were Academy Award nominations, Gods of Metal and The School of Assassins, one of which is back there on the table. He's a recipient of the Pax Christi, a Catholic peace and justice group, the Teacher of Peace Award in 1997. Due to his outspoken and courageous nature, he has spent a grand total of about 4 years in prison for peaceful protests. In 1998, he testified in Madrid before a Spanish judge seeking the extradition of Chile's ex-dictator, Augusto Pinochet. When he finds himself out of prison, he finds himself at universities giving talks. We're very privileged to have Father Roy with us. He's going to reveal a number of uglier sides of humanity, but ultimately his message is one of hope, one of challenge, and ultimately one of peace, so desperately needed. So if we may give a warm WJU welcome to Father Roy Bourgeois.
Thank you, Father Mike. I want to thank you for being here. I want to say it's an honor to be at your university, and I appreciate the warm hospitality of the Jesuit community. As Father Mike said, we're at a difficult time personally and as a nation. We're struggling with a lot. We've been really inflicted with a lot of violence. We mourn with those who mourn, grieve with those who grieve. Our country now is consumed with a lot of anger. And we know that that anger can take us down roads sometimes that we don't want to travel if it dominates us. We can lose touch with our faith, with our hope. I really believe that as we come together as people of faith, as people of conscience, that we're called to be peacemakers in our world, healers, to do the best we can where we are. But we need others to help us along the journey, and certain experiences, hopefully, that will get us on that journey to peace. A Spanish poet, Machado, I think, says it very well. And he says, "Caminante, no hay camino, el camino se hace al andar." This road to peace, he says, sojourners that we are, it's not clear. There's no clear-cut path, especially for us today. It's challenging. But that road to peace, he said, is made by walking. Growing up in a small town in Louisiana, we didn't talk much about what we're going to talk about tonight: peace, justice, healing, foreign policy. We sort of left that to those in Washington, thinking they knew best about what we should be doing in our country. I went off to the State University in Louisiana to study geology. Worked hard at that degree, as many of you are doing here, and with the hope of getting rich in the oil fields of South America. Out of college, Vietnam was in the making. I became a naval officer, being a patriotic young man. I felt it was my responsibility to serve my country. Was aboard ship for a couple of years. I loved to travel. It was good to be out at sea. It was my ticket out of Louisiana. Went off to a NATO station in Europe for a year. And then when our leaders were asking us to go off to Vietnam to stop the spread of communism, I did not hesitate. I volunteered for shore duty there. Vietnam, for many of us there, became a turning point in our lives. We went off to this distant country we knew so little about, its people, its culture, its history. We were warriors. We were young men with guns, very adventurous, believing in our cause as a noble one. But something happened there in the midst of the violence, the suffering, the death. We began to change. How could we not? Losing friends there, wounded when I was there, I was forced to look at my faith more seriously, to raise questions I had never raised before. Really, for the first time in my life, I started to question this whole issue of violence. I'm a person, as you are, I need hope in my life. As I look back, growing up in the bayous of Louisiana, I mean, I always felt hope in my life and how important that was in my life. Always kind of looking forward to something better and feeling that it was, you know, it was going to happen. But in Vietnam, I was moving into despair. The hope was gone because I began to see what was going on there. It's really hopeless, as a dead-end street. I met a missionary near our base running an orphanage with a small staff. He was a peacemaker, a healer. He and this small staff caring for these 300 children whose parents were killed, many of them wounded. I would go there to do volunteer work with my buddies. And we began, as we went about our work there, I began to feel something different. Same things were stirring up in me. I saw them as they went about their work as healers, peacemakers, and I simply said, what a wonderful way to spend one's life. I saw some hope here. And I didn't know where all of this was going to lead, but it certainly was grace at work. I think a loving God always trying to call us to be more human, less violent, more compassionate. I talked to an Army chaplain about missionary work, and he recommended the Maryknoll Order. And I said, Mary who? I had never heard of Maryknoll. A group working in 26 countries around the world trying to serve the poor. And I left Vietnam really so grateful to be back home, reunited with family and friends. But I had changed. I really wanted to put the life of a warrior behind me, to try and, I don't know, travel that road to peace wherever that was going to lead. It wasn't clear cut. It never is. I entered the Maryknoll community, and years later I was ordained and assigned to our missions in Bolivia, a slum on the outskirts of La Paz, the capital, became my home for the next 5 years. And it was here really that I was educated by those I went to serve. The poor became my teachers. First, they taught me about their lives, their struggle. And really, that's the starting point of this issue that I'm going to be addressing tonight. The starting point is there in Latin America, where the vast majority of our sisters and brothers are struggling for survival, living on the edge, in these shacks without running water, not receiving just wages for their labor, not having schools for their kids, and when they get sick, there's not a clinic or a hospital to go to for those medicines. And so many will die before the age of 3 or 4. This is Latin America. This is the developing world, as most of the people in our developing countries live. And then there's another side. There in Bolivia was a dictator, General Hugo Banzer, who had come into power through a violent coup. It saddened me to see my country supporting, propping up this dictator and his men with the guns throughout the country defending that socioeconomic system that kept the small elite very powerful, very wealthy, and the vast majority very poor. And the large corporations coming in from our country and other first world countries seeking profits where there are huge profits to be made from the cheap labor and the vast resources. The poor often refer to them as the new conquistadors, as they came to Latin America from Spain and Portugal in the 16th century to enrich themselves. So too today they're coming in from our country and other countries to exploit that cheap labor and those resources. It was in Bolivia that I was introduced to a new theology, a theology that gives hope to people. For a long time, the poor have been taught a theology that's been very cruel, saying to them they should accept their suffering as God's will, to endure it, to look forward to the next life where their joy would come. But today that's changing as they gather in their small comunidades, their base, communities, to read and reflect on the scriptures. Well, they come to discover a loving God, a creator who does not want them to suffer, but rather has given to their country and every country so many blessings, so many resources, where there's enough for everyone, but was put there, however, for everyone to share and to live comfortably, has now ended up, because of greed and selfishness, foreign policy, militarism, it's now in the hands of a small group. And the central issue, of course, is irresponsible stewardship of God's creation. And this is what's going on in Latin America, in the developing world today. The poor, the oppressed of our world are saying, basta, enough. We are not going to sit back as we've done for so many years and simply endure this misery, this oppression. They are becoming empowered by their faith, liberated by their education, and they are doing what we would do if we were living under those conditions. We would be saying, basta. We're human beings. We have a right to just wages, adequate housing, schools, hospitals. They want the same things in life that we want here. It was in my fifth year I was arrested with a group at the university because of speaking out against the repression. I came home. It was a hard time in my life. I didn't really know what to do. Tried to get back, was denied a visa. I joined many friends here at home whose attention was turned to El Salvador, a situation worse than what I experienced in Bolivia. Small country in Central America, 5 million people the size of Massachusetts, country at war. There, 14 families had ended up with 65% of the land, the most fertile land, where they grew coffee to export to our country and other countries. And they lived very well in their mansions with their servants. Those who worked in their fields couldn't make it on a dollar a day. And as they spoke out, they were killed, disappeared, tortured. And those who spoke on behalf of the poor, Archbishop Oscar Romero, was gunned down in church for his defense of the poor. Just months later, 4 churchwomen from our country were raped and killed by the Salvadoran soldiers. 2 of their Marino sisters, Maura Clark and Edith Ward. With them was Ursuline's sister, Dorothy Kazel, and lay missioner Gene Donovan from Cleveland. When this happened, many of us went to El Salvador to find out what was going on. We found what the women found, the microcosm of Latin America. What we also found was our country giving guns to those soldiers doing the killing. And that was wrong. That was immoral, a crime against humanity. And when 525 soldiers came from El Salvador to this big army base, Fort Benning in Georgia, to start training here on U.S. soil in combat, I went there with friends to protest. We gave talks at, we rented this little house called it Casa Romero, and we started organizing, giving talks at Auburn University, at our state college in town, and anyone who would listen to us. And then we decided to take the message to the Salvadoran soldiers on Fort Benning. Linda Ventimiglia, who was in the Army Reserves, were trained at Fort Benning. Larry Rosebaum, who was an oblate priest who had worked in Brazil. And myself, we went down to Ranger Joe's, Army Surplus Place. We bought Army uniforms. We dressed as high-ranking Army officers. And we went on to Fort Benning at night, carrying with us this powerful boombox that had in it the last sermon in Spanish of Bishop Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, where he made a special plea to the men in the military, saying to them, stop the killing. Lay down your arms. Disobey your superior officers telling you to kill, and obey a higher law that says thou shalt not kill. We took the words of this prophet Oscar Romero with us. We penetrated this high security area, got saluted. It was a shaky salute. We were very scared. Went near the barracks. With tree climbers, Linda, Larry, and I, we scaled this tall pine tree about 30 feet up there. We secured the boom box, and we waited. And about 10 o'clock at night, when the last lights went out, soldiers turning in after a long day of being trained in how to kill, we said, Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother. And his voice just boomed into the barracks. They were very upset with us. It came out of there. Some of those soldiers came out of the barracks, a little frightened, hearing the voice of this prophet, Romero. They knew who he was. They couldn't see us under the cover of the darkness there. The instructors came out with their guns, M16s, their dogs, the light source up there, threatened to shoot us down. If we didn't come down, it was time to come down. Left the boom box up there blasting away. They handcuffed us, kicked us around, took us to the county jail and then to trial. Before this well-known judge, Judge Robert Elliott, who's become known in the movement as Maximum Bob, didn't like protesters, sent Martin Luther King and civil rights leaders to prison for protesting during the civil rights movement. He sent us to prison for 18 months, charged with criminal trespass and impersonating officers. Linda went to a prison in Kentucky, Larry to Latuna, Texas, and I ended up in Sandstone, Minnesota. Prison was hard, lonely at times, but we learned something very important. They could send us to prison, but they could not silence us. The truth cannot be silenced. What I also learned was that, they didn't know it at the time, but those years in the seminary were good preparation for prison. I also heard a Jesuit say that, a Jesuit who went to prison, that the Jesuit seminary was good preparation. We wrote hundreds of letters from prison, had a lot of media interviews, spoke from prison. And we get out of prison and we join thousands of people in our country trying to stop that military aid, but we couldn't do it. Our voices weren't strong enough. It got up to $1 million a day, all from our taxes. Most of it going into the hands of the military at war with this people. November the 16th, 1989, front pages of our newspapers, another massacre. This time, six Jesuit priests there at the university in San Salvador. Their co-worker, a young mother, and her 15-year-old daughter, Selena. They're dragged out of their rooms, and they're killed, shot at close range. Many of our members of Congress, educated at Jesuit colleges, high schools all over the country, they become very upset. El Salvador comes closer to home. They send a congressional task force to investigate, headed by Representative Joseph Moakley from Massachusetts. He said this task force there changed his life forever. He came back and reported that those responsible for the massacre of the two women and the six Jesuits were trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. When I read that report, I was very happy there in Minnesota, where I'd been working for 3 years, going out to a lot of colleges in the Midwest, talking about El Salvador. And I felt it was time to break camp and go back to Georgia, find out what the School of the Americas was all about. We knew so little about it. I went down with the blessing from my Marino community. Right outside of the main gate, found this little apartment that was vacant. A soldier had just been transferred. I was joined by friends. Charlie Litke came, recipient of the Medal of Honor in Vietnam. A Jesuit from Boston joined us. Two Dominican priests. Kathy Kelly from Chicago, doing a lot today on Iraq. Two Salvadorans from the university there in El Salvador who was forced out of the country with death threats. We began with a three-day retreat, reflecting kind of what are we going to do now. We decided to begin our presence with a very serious water-only fast that went 35 days. We didn't eat, sustained ourselves only on water. Our bodies were growing very weak, but our spirit was strong. We ended our fast. Food never tasted so good, and we had to get to work. We got strong again and started doing research on this school. And what we found, helped along by members of Congress and human rights reports from Latin America, We learned that this School of the Americas began in Panama way back in 1946. Our U.S. Army training facility to train Latin American soldiers in combat, they said, to bring stability to their countries. The question, of course, stability for whom? It became known as a school for dictators. General Manuel Noriega, the best known probably, went through this school. He's in a Florida federal prison doing 30 years for drug running. General Hugo Banzer from Bolivia, another notorious graduate, not only a graduate, but in 1988 inducted into the school's Hall of Fame, where his photograph is hanging on the wall with some 20 other generals presented as model soldiers. Roberto Dubasan from El Salvador, a well-known death squad leader, another graduate. And the list goes on and on. In 1984, the school is booted out of Panama. General Noriega said he no longer wanted this training ground for assassins on Panamanian soil. It was giving Panama, he said, a bad name. So it now settled at Fort Benning, Georgia, 1984. Where today it's operating full force, training every year about 1,200, some 1,500 soldiers every year in combat skills. Most of the courses, commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency techniques. They have recently implemented a few hours of human rights training there to appease the critics. We didn't realize how serious this issue was until 1993 when the United Nations Truth Commission report on El Salvador was made public. We learned that those who assassinated Bishop Romero were trained here. Those who raped and killed the four church women were graduates. Of the 26 responsible for the massacre of the six Jesuits and the two women, 19 of them graduates. And then there's El Masote, over 800 there killed in a remote village. Over 100 children included. Of the 12 responsible, 10 of them graduates. But it wasn't only El Salvador. 9 university students killed in Peru, those responsible graduates. Battalion 316, a death squad group in Honduras, the key players, graduates. And the list went on and on. We knew if we got this information into colleges, church groups, peace groups, people in our country would have to pay attention to this. Sure enough, the first group coming on board, the Presbyterian Church, USA, with the 6.5 million people, passed a resolution to close the school. And then the Leadership Conference of Women Religious came on board, 87,000 nuns as members. And look out, things really began to happen. Pax Christi groups, Amnesty International chapters coming on board. NAACP passing a resolution. Veterans for Peace. The United Methodist Bishops, United Church of Christ. The U.S. Catholic bishops, over half of them, signing on to a resolution to close it. Editorials began to appear in newspapers around the country to shut it down, receiving letters from many, many people in the area. Here's the New York Times editorial, School of the Dictators, the Boston Globe, School of the Assassins, the Des Moines Register, a school not needed. The Cleveland Plain Dealer, a school for closing. The Chicago Tribune, lights out at the School of the Americas. The Los Angeles Times, bury this relic. The Atlanta Constitution, shut down the School of the Assassins. And what got the school in big trouble? Front page of the Washington Post, these manuals discovered at the school that advocated torture. U.S. instructed Latins on executions and torture. This really got the attention of a lot of members of Congress. Not long after we began our little SOA watch office, word began to spread. the stories of the martyrs began to reach here to us at home. Now, this is what was going on. Their stories began to get into our campuses, workplaces, faith communities. And at some point, a movement began to take root, a movement that was rooted in nonviolence. We knew it had to be rooted in nonviolence. And we drew on the experience of Dr. King and Mahatma Gandhi, Dorothy Day, and others. That was going to be our way. And many people of faith in this movement, of course, knew their own. Their faith also called them to nonviolence if they were to be faithful. Every November, we would go down to Georgia. It became really the focal point of our movement. We would gather at the main gate to say, not in our name is this going to continue. That first November, to commemorate the massacre of the Jesuits and the two women, and to remember all the others killed by graduates of this school, we had a handful of people. The next year, 200 came. The next year, 600. This last November, 10,000 gathered there, 10,000 from all over the country. Half of those there were college students, many of them about 2,000 Jesuit students. Those who are with us this evening, who are with, you know, here, who were down in Georgia with us last November or November's past, could you please stand? I know some of you were with us. Thank you, thank you. I know you were there. You know the experience. It was a celebration of hope. We were there to try and keep alive the memory of the victims. We were there to try and use our voices for the voiceless. That Saturday, speakers, musicians to uplift the spirit. And then on Sunday, more solemn. It was cold, it was raining, but the spirit was so strong. I've never seen it that strong. And among the 10,000 there, again, I'm about 5,000 students from all over the country, the Jesuits meeting in this big tent as they're going to meet again this November for the Ignatian teach-in. We also had a lot of veterans among the 10,000, senior citizens, parents with their children. And then on Sunday, 3,500 enter Fort Benning after the memorial service in a solemn funeral procession. We crossed this white line they painted across the road. They said to us, if you enter that, cross that white line, you're breaking the law. 3,500 said there's a higher law to follow. A law that says that thou shalt not kill. A law that says we are to be peacemakers, healers in our world. A law that says we are to walk in solidarity with the poor. And on this day, that's what we're going to follow. And they enter carrying coffins, white crosses, some with the Star of David bearing the names of the victims, some holding photographs, the Jesuits, the churchwomen, Romero and others. And each of their names are called off over the PA system. And after each name comes presente. This person is with us today. Something very sacred going on here. In a very real way, we're connecting our lives to sisters and brothers in Latin America. Liturgy at its finest. Many there are weeping. That's what happens when we touch the sacred. Down the road, everyone is stopped. Many are processed. You can't arrest 3,500 people. There aren't that many jail cells in Columbus, Georgia for that. They go after 24. They found that about 65 had crossed the line the year before. they're repeat offenders. So among the 65, they sent 25 to trial, charged them with trespassing, and sent to prison for 6 months. In prison, as we gather, are 24 of our people and federal prisons all over the country. 8 of the women are at a federal prison in Illinois, outside of Chicago. The youngest among them is Rachel Hayward, 19 years old, a sophomore at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. Among the oldest there, senior citizen, Sister Dorothy Hennessy, a sister of St. Joseph from Dubuque, Iowa, who's 88 years old. I don't know what they were thinking of when they sent Dorothy to prison. She's been getting a lot of media attention. On Good Morning America, before she went to prison, big articles in the New York Times, the London Times, just a few weeks ago, were down, sent a reporter down to interview her. They thought maybe by sending them to prison, they could kill our movement. Every time they send us to prison, it simply energizes the movement. 60 of our people before them went to prison and collectively have served some 40 years in prison. While those who did the killing trained at this school walked. You can't touch these bullies in Latin America. That's the power of the military there. Most of the soldiers from attending the School of the Americas today come from Colombia. Just a brief word about Colombia. I was with a delegation there recently to check into Plan Colombia. We are pumping $1.3 billion into Colombia to fight it, what they say, a drug war, to try and stop the flow of cocaine into our country. We talked with the high-ranking military there. They love this aid. It's making them even more powerful, enriching them. And then we went down to Putumayo, the southern region of Colombia, to talk to the victims of this plan. We met with the indigenous leaders, the small farmers who had come in, walked long distances to meet with our delegation, Bishop Tom Gumbleton, among our group. And here's what's going on there. We're spraying this strong chemical called glyphosate produced by Monsanto that brought us Agent Orange in Vietnam. It's intended, these low-flying planes, to kill the coca leaves, the raw substance which will come the cocaine. But what's happening, this spraying is also killing their banana trees, the rice, the yuca, food sources. It's going into their rivers. It's killing their fish. They brought us into their homes where we met their children suffering from respiratory problems, skin rashes. And they had a very, very serious question for us. They asked us as North Americans, how would you feel, they said, if we were in your country spraying this stuff on your food, your children? We know this would be unheard of here. Unheard of. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's a grave injustice. It's our country's at work through its foreign policy, using militarism once again. And it's got to stop. It's got to stop. After September the 11th, we called a lot of our people around the country in the midst of all of them, mourning and grieving. We asked university leaders in our movement, parents, veterans, nuns, clergy, and others, should we go back to Georgia this year at the main gate? And overwhelmingly, everyone said, yes, of course, we have to be there. Because more than ever, we have to be there to confront this issue of violence. There is on U.S. soil a school that really leads to a lot of violence in Latin America, a lot of terrorism. All finance for our taxes to the tune of about $15 million a year. And we want that to stop. And so we're going back. We're going to be back this November, next month. November the 16th, 17th, and 18th. On November the 16th, we'll begin the Ignatian teaching in this big tent, once again, that the Jesuits are in. Most of the 28 Jesuit colleges from all over the country will be represented there. And I know some of you will be going, and that's going to be extremely important. It will be a great blessing to our movement to have your college, your university represented, as in the past. And we're going to talk together. We're going to meet together. We're going to pray together, reflect together. More than ever before, we need each other to come together, to talk about nonviolence, about peace, about love, about solidarity, about how are we going to break down these barriers that separate us. And needless to say, we've got to start asking some very, very serious questions at this time. Perhaps a little threatening for many in our country. And the question, of course, is you know, how do people of other countries perceive us? There are some in our country who are trying to present our country as the Mother Teresa of the world. We're very saintly. We just give, 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 and don't expect anything in return. As I saw a letter to the editor recently in the USA Today. We have to remind ourselves that our country has 5% of the world's population, but yet we consume about 50% of its resources. And what I heard in Latin America and what many, many are saying in other developing countries, it's this, that there is a causal relationship between our wealth, our power, our lifestyles here, and how they are living there. The poverty, the misery, the powerlessness there. Can this be a teachable moment for us? I think it can. I think it can. Can our faith really endure this? Are we able to root ourselves in our faith? Look seriously at the teachings of Jesus and ask, what would Jesus do at a time like this? Can we draw on the wisdom and experiences of people like Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, Dorothy Day? We need them with us today more than ever before. But they're not with us. But we can do it, you and I. We can use our voices for peace, for nonviolence, as they did. And the words of Bishop Romero are so, so appropriate right now, the moment we find ourselves in. Before he was assassinated, he said, "Let those who have a voice speak for the voiceless. Speak for peace. Speak for nonviolence." We here, we have a voice. May we speak clearly and boldly at this time. Thank you.